Confronting the opioid crisis, what's being done on the ground to save lives? Just about a year ago, Governor Mills created a new position, the State Director of Opioid Response, and appointed Gordon Smith to fill it. Since then, a lot has happened, including the expansion of medication-assisted treatment and the training of 250 new recovery coaches. Still, the numbers are discouraging. It's estimated that last year, an average of 6 people in Maine died each week from a drug overdose, the majority of which were tied to opioid misuse. That is down from the peak in 2017, but not dramatically. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Gordon Smith and others who are leading the charge against the opioid epidemic join me to discuss the state's strategy for confronting it. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For the past year, combating the opioid epidemic has been a top state priority, but the complexity of this crisis makes it difficult to address. Today, we'll hear what the strategies are to stem opioid use in Maine and how it's going. Joining me in our studio, Gordon Smith. He is the State Director of Opioid Response. Donna Lawler is also here. She's Clinical Director for the Health Care for the Homeless with Greater Portland Health. And on the line with us, Elaine O'Connor, a nurse practitioner with Maine General, whose focus is addiction medicine. She co-chairs the state's Opioid Response Clinical Advisory Committee. As always, we want to hear from you. Is anyone you know affected by opioid use? What do you think needs to be done to deal with the crisis in Maine? Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for being here. Gordon, welcome back to Maine Calling. And I want to start with you, Gordon, if you could just sort of give us an update. Some of the headlines this year have been discouraging, that we seem to have seen a little bit of a surge in overdose deaths. Where are we in terms of what the numbers were for 2019, and why do we think this continues to be such a difficult problem?
Well, it is a very difficult problem, and it's been just about a year since I was on and was appointed to work with the governor on this difficult issue. People were disappointed to learn that our overdose numbers will probably be up about 4% after declining by 15% the previous year. So I think a lot of people hoped that that line would just keep coming down after it had gone up for 8 years. But frankly, it's simply not that simple. And it's, if anything, it's a reminder to people that we've been 25 years to get to this point, and there's not one silver bullet that all of a sudden everything's going to be fine. It is stunning, in my opinion, still to lose 370 people a year in the state of Maine to this issue. In another year, we will probably have reached, since 2010, about 3,000 deaths. That's just unbelievable. And we're aggressively trying to deal with it. But in truth, the number of overdose deaths, although a lot of people are fixated on that, is not a good proxy for determining the value of our work. A lot of our work needs to be in that primary prevention space. We're trying to save as many people as we can, give them a fair chance for recovery. And I do think we've been successful community by community in helping to change that narrative. I think the overdose deaths will get better. But in the meantime, we simply have to recommit ourselves to doing everything that we can to respond. The overdose deaths are really a function of how dangerous are the drugs in the community that particular day. And as the drugs become more and more powerful, the most recent spike in Portland was really cocaine laced with fentanyl. And fortunately, in the latest spike, 11 people were revived and lived. In December, 5 people died. And so it's those drugs are very dangerous, and we have to do a lot of things right, including the law enforcement piece and interdiction and trying to stop these products from getting into Maine. So it's complicated.
So I'm listening to you, and there are layers. The layer is keeping people from even using opioids in the first place, taking those who are using and helping them get off, making sure the opioids coming into the state are not as dangerous as others, and doing this all for how much money?
Well, we'll never have enough resources to deal with it, but we are, with the federal resources and private philanthropy and some money that the legislature has made available, we're putting, you know, $10 to $20 million at least annually into this issue. But it's also a changing target in that, you know, while we talk about the opioid issue, it's obviously not about opioids only. We've got now lots of parts of Maine now have moved to stimulants, cocaine and meth particularly. Meth has always been an issue in Aroostook County. And so our policies need to adapt to those to those strategies.
Donna, tell us about the populations that you're working with. These are people who are either homeless or living really sort of on the edge, correct?
Correct. At Greater Portland Health and Preble Street, we do see a majority of people experiencing homelessness and often suffering from mental health and polysubstance use. So we want to kind of help them recognize both the dual diagnosis and treating both the mental health as well as the substance use issue.
How do you help your population?
I mean, it's a very difficult situation with homelessness and maintaining the safety around the medication that you do have. So we do have a daily dosing program where we give folks medication, Suboxone, every day, see them. We work very closely with Preble Street Resource Center to provide intensive case management to help folks get out of their homelessness and into a place where they can begin working and living stably in affordable housing. So it's a complicated issue where unless you address affordable housing and employment and help folks get into a place where they can do those things, you run into a lot of difficulties with maintaining sobriety.
So, it seems so difficult. Do you have success stories?
We have a lot of success stories. Most importantly is not maintaining a very low barrier so that we're not turning people away or discharging them out of our practice because of polysubstance use, specifically methamphetamine use, which often can be laced or cut at the same time with opiates. And the Suboxone saves their lives in that respect, or if they do relapse, Suboxone will prevent overdose death from relapse. And so part of the thing that we do is not discharge people just because they're struggling, because they're relapsing, because their life is in a place where they're just having a hard time with recovery. So that's the most important thing, I think, and then providing that intensive case management to help them put the pieces back together and get themselves into a place of recovery and stability. So working closely with the case managers at Preble Street and really providing intensive case management helps folks kind of take the time they need to move into recovery. It's a very bumpy road. It's a very curvy road. So there are relapses all the time, and not giving up on them when they hit a bump in the road, I think, is our most important reason for success.
Elaine, I want to turn to you. Tell us what you're focusing on with your patients at Maine General.
So I have sort of a slightly different perspective in that a lot of the patients I work with are from very rural populations. So I work predominantly out of Waterville, but serve, Somerset County, Kennebec, Northern Kennebec, and places like that. Some of our biggest challenges are really the transportation side of things, because patients will have to travel, 45 minutes to an hour to get to us. And that's been one of the biggest pieces, frankly, of the expanded access to main care, is that with access to insurance, oftentimes comes access to transportation. So patients are just so much more able to get to us and get the care that they need. We also really try hard to offer integrated care. So patients can come to the office and, get their addiction treatment, get their substance use counseling, potentially even get their primary care right all at the same time. So it affords then the opportunity to only have to come once to get a multitude of services, which reduces a lot of the barriers, transportation, childcare, and other issues that they might encounter. So we're really working toward offering a lot of integrated care up here.
And my understanding is that a lot of the work that you're doing is with women who are pregnant who are using opioids. Talk to me about what you are able to do for someone who is using and discovers she's pregnant.
So we do specialize in that, and it's incredibly rewarding to work with this population. I mean, we just try to get them into treatment as quickly as possible. So, as soon as they identify that they're pregnant and needing access to services, we really try to provide comprehensive wraparound care that addresses all their needs, their transportation, their housing, their food insecurity, sometimes domestic violence issues. So really trying to work on all the other issues that might be present in their life. And then we provide integrated care, again, to give them all the care that they need at the same time, but really just try to provide, non-judgmental, warm, compassionate, supportive care. And really the focus is, welcoming moms here and making them feel like this is a safe place for them to enter recovery. It's a group that encounters stigma in almost every, walk of life. There's a lot of judgment toward pregnant women with substance use disorders, so we just really try to make this a safe place for them to get care and to really understand that getting into treatment is the safest thing for them and their babies, and then sort of walking them through that process of what it looks like when you deliver a baby and how that will work. Is pain going to be handled and things like that? But they have a lot of questions, and if Child Protective will be involved, there's a lot of teaching and education that needs to happen. But mostly, we just try to make it a safe place for them to come and get the care that they need.
And Charlene, I'm listening to this and I'm thinking to myself, is there fear? Are people not coming to you who you believe could use the help because they're afraid that their children will be taken away?
I mean, I think that's a common, misperception that's out there. And I think we try to sort of educate that getting into treatment is the safest option. I mean, are there people that avoid it? Probably. But we really just try to explain to them that the safest thing for them and their baby is to enter treatment, and that, that certainly enhances the likelihood that they'll be able to parent the child in the way they want to be able to parent. If they're stable and doing well and engaged in recovery support and services, that's really the safest and best option for them. But certainly we're aware that there's fear around that, and we certainly understand that, and we really try to have an open and honest dialogue about that as we enroll moms in treatment.
Gordon, a big part of the reason we're doing the program today is because you've come out with a strategic action plan and to respond to Maine's opioid epidemic. You've given me a copy. I have the 8 pages in my hands, 8 pages, very small print. But I just want to bring up a couple points. One is that already 250 recovery coaches in the system, people who are going to help others. But something that struck me in reading up for today's program is that 5,000 people are now in who were not before are now in medication-assisted treatment through the Maine Care expansion, and congratulations on that. That's a terrific achievement, but it makes me think, what is the scale of this problem if it just the past year 5,000 more people are in medication-assisted treatment?
Well, the scale is overwhelming, and the needs are great. To give you a couple other data points, actually there's now over 6,000 patients in the Maine Care expansion population that are filing claims for substance use disorder. There's even more for treatment of substance use disorder, and that's a good thing. There's even more patients who are filing claims for mental health treatment. And boy, they are related, as Donna has said. So, but I'll give you another. Just this week, the report of our syringe exchanges, which is a yearly report, and we're expanding our syringe exchanges. But there were last year over 5,600 distinct clients who are obviously intravenous drug users who we don't want them spreading hepatitis C or HIV, and we've had a 300% explosion in hepatitis C cases since 2015. So, but I frequently try to get these data sources together and say, well, how many, instead of focusing on how many people died, how many people are getting treatment that weren't, how many people are denied treatment or on a waiting list, and how many people are using and in trouble and not even seeking treatment? Because nationally, they claim that, and I have no reason to dispute these experts, that only 10% of the people with a substance use disorder even seek treatment, largely because of stigma. And every day, we're in these communities trying to break down the three kinds of stigma that we deal with. And I do think that the governor and this effort has been successful in changing the narrative. A lot of media people will say, well, what's been your biggest success in the first year? And I do think we're now delivering a message of hope and recovery, and that with the right resources and with the right environment, that we have lots of success stories. There are millions of people in successful recovery. And in that way, Suboxone, or buprenorphine is the formal name, it really is helping people stay in long-term recovery. I hear this every day, that people who were in and out, and relapsing, or now we call a reoccurrence, is a better non-stigmatizing term. Now they're able to stay in long-term recovery because of Suboxone, but there's stigma associated with Suboxone. So we are from communities from Stonington to Freiburg to Bethel to Lincoln to Millinocket, trying every night to break down the stigma and get people into recovery and give them hope. That has been our success.
Gordon, so as you try to figure out these numbers, how many people do you think are struggling with some sort of trouble? How many people are in trouble with opioids in the state of Maine, do you think, to use your word?
Well, there are thousands, obviously. If you just take that, the distinct clients for the needle exchange, and figure that they're probably also coming in for some other people. So I figure that's probably 10,000 IV drug users in the state. And that's not counting the people who are suffering from chronic alcoholism and other types of multi-polysubstance use. So I would take those national figures at what extent to, in the country, what percent of the population have a substance use disorder diagnosed or not, and it's, what would you say, Donna, at least 10% of the population?
Probably.
So in Maine, that would be 130,000 people. So again, it ranges from functional alcoholism to IV drug use. But if we're not addressing the root causes of addiction, you know, and working with kids from the time they're born, even in the prenatal period, early Head Start, right through grade 12, and I give the Department of Education and our Maine Prevention Services, there's some terrific work being done. But if we're not helping those 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds who are starting to use alcohol in middle school, then we're going to need 100 directors of opioid response, not one.
Well, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, some of your comments and questions. We're talking about the state's strategy against the opioid epidemic. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Portland Ovations. Celebrating Mardi Gras with Adonis Rose and the New Orleans Jazz Orchestra, February 20th, portlandovations.org. Beardoff Galleries hosting its fine art auction on February 22nd in South Portland. Learn more at beardoff.com. and Breakwater Curiosity for Life, offering exceptional day school and after-school options for toddlers through 8th grade. BreakwaterLearning.org.
A design debate is brewing in our nation's capital. Some architects say President Trump's call for classical architecture of new federal buildings doesn't make sense.
In the 21st century, we're very different people from the people who popularized Greek Revival architecture in the 19th century.
Trump's plan to, quote, make federal buildings beautiful again this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon at 4 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine.
In 2016, my daughter was born in the Congo. Her name is Tigva. It means hope. We didn't know that she was born with a liver deformity that was life-threatening. It's called biliary atresia. There was no treatment, no medication, no follow-up, no nothing for her in the Congo. She was doomed for death. The only hope she could have was a place like America, and especially a place like Maine. I am forever grateful to the state of Maine and to the people of Maine for the life of my daughter and for the future that I see myself having here. My name is Luke Samuel from Portland, and this is my Maine.
This Is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to MainePublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the challenges of dealing with opioid use in Maine and what the state's plan is to help. My guests are Elaine O'Connor, who is a nurse practitioner with Maine General, who co-chairs the state's Opioid Response Clinical Advisory Committee. Donna Lawler is here with me, Clinical Director for Healthcare for the Homeless with Greater Portland Health, and Gordon Smith, the State Director of Opioid Response. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go to the mother of a recovering addict calling from the Lewiston area who doesn't want her name on the air, but go ahead and go ahead with your question for Gordon Smith and the others on our panel.
Okay. My son has been he's 48 years old and has been struggling. He has a TBI. He's an MHI consent decree member. He has an anxiety disorder and depression. He's homeless and trying to live on SSDI. He's in a methadone treatment program in Lewiston, but he can't find a place to live that he can afford on SSDI. And all the rooming houses and stuff are full of people who are using, and he wants to stay clean. He's only been clean 2 years. He died. He overdosed. They brought him back with Narcan, and he's homeless, and he's living with me, and my landlady doesn't want me to have anyone living here with me. So I want to know what you're going to do for the homeless people who have multiple disabilities and are recovering from opioid addiction.
Sure. Thank you so much for your call. And, you know, I want to turn first to you, Donna. This is a huge problem for the people you work with, isn't it? Finding a place they can afford to live.
Yes, that's correct. housing is a big issue, both in Portland and in Lewiston, although it's a very difficult and hard situation. Your son has a traumatic brain injury, which should qualify him for some additional case management support that I would hope could assist him in obtaining some assistance with finding housing. You know, I can speak for Portland around programming that we have coming down where, you know, our case managers will have additional funding thanks to Gordon and the state's grant funding to help folks obtain housing. And I'm going to turn to Gordon around what programming might be available in Lewiston.
There's two really important initiatives. I want to shout out to Drew Gatine, who sponsored the bill as a and the contracts are being worked on. There's a project for in an urban area, which will be in Portland, for 25 homeless individuals with substance use disorder, and to pay for their housing and to get them into treatment, keep them in treatment, and also one in a rural area. So Portland, at least for 25 people, they're really going to be helped. But there's $2 million that was sent by the Substance Abuse Services Agency to the Maine State Housing Authority under legislation that was presented and passed by Shenna Bellows. So that's going to enhance the 107 so-called sober houses or recovery residences we have in the state. And that's going to make quite a difference, because to get our to get this money, you have to be nationally certified as a home, and you can't discriminate against the Suboxone people on Suboxone.
Which is a change, correct?
It is a change. And even now, fewer than 20, you know, will take a patient on Suboxone. But that will that is improving day by day. And we hope, we probably need 200 recovery residences in the state, but we're the one about to open for the first time in Aroostook County in Caribou. There's one for Moms and Children's about to open in Machias. So we are putting a lot into recovery housing. It's an important part. You can't expect people to get into recovery, stay in recovery, if they don't have a roof over their head. So absolutely, and some of these properties will absolutely be in Androscoggin County. So hang in there. Help is on the way.
All right. Well, good luck to you and your son. And thank you so much for calling in today. We're going to turn now to Lisa Letourneau. She is the Senior Advisor for Delivery System Change with Maine's Department of Health and Human Services. Lisa, thanks for calling in.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me.
I understand that some of the state's efforts to address the opioid epidemic are getting significant federal funds. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, we have seen significant attention from the federal government for this epidemic of opioid use and misuse. So, you know, the slight silver lining on this. And that really comes to the state in many ways. Possibly the most important way right now is through states being able to expand their Medicaid programs, which, as you know, Governor Mills did just about a year ago, which is significantly supported by federal funds. So two-thirds of the Medicaid dollars come from the federal coffers, one-third from the state. So the fact that we've been able to expand Medicaid to an additional 44,000-plus people, many of whom have substance use disorder, as Gordon referenced, again, is a huge asset to the state. These folks before Medicaid expansion just didn't have access to treatment. Additionally, there's a whole range of federal programs that provide funding all the way from existing block grants to our Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Agency, SAMHS, that goes to help provide treatment for the uninsured, to all kinds of programs. Gordon has referenced things like syringe exchange programs, recovery coach support. There's really a wide range. Additionally, other federal agencies, so that's out of SAMHSA, federal agencies such as CDC provide funds to the state through our own Center for Disease Control, or CDC, for efforts around prevention, data tracking and reporting, and then others such as the Health Research Services Administration, HRSA, providing funds directly in some cases to federally qualified health centers to expand their capacity for treatment, and to communities. There's a whole set of community rural community opioid response planning grants, and several communities in Maine have successfully applied for and secured those funds. So the list is very long. Gordon's probably better at it than I am, but there's many, many programs.
Lisa, I'm sure you intended to mention the MOM grant.
Oh, thank you, Gordon. Yes, also. Thank you. So one of the most recent ones comes from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, to 10 states, of which Maine is one, to fund a program called the Maternal Opioid Misuse, or MOM. We're calling it the Maine MOM program. Elaine is also very involved as a clinical lead there, and that will provide funds both to the state and up to six clinical, calling delivery partners, six provider organizations to deliver an integrated model of care, much like Elaine described she currently does in her community in the Augusta-Waterville area, so that pregnant women get a broader range of supports and integrated OB care and substance use care in the same setting, ideally.
Lisa, before we let you go, I want to ask you about one more thing. I understand there's a treatment locator. Tell me about that and how people can access it.
Yeah, well, it's being developed. So that's another federal grant, actually, that Maine just secured through what's called the Federal Support Act funding. We're using it in Maine to fund the program we call Support for Me, that will fund a range of activities to better assess and strengthen Maine's system of treatment and recovery for substance use disorder. Part of that project is right now funding the development of something we're calling a treatment locator, which is basically a way that the public, first responders, police, providers, families could go to one place and identify where can my son or daughter or friend or person who is just revived on the street go for treatment for their substance use disorder. As Gordon mentioned, we know that still, sadly, a minority of people with substance use disorder and opioid use disorder get evidence-based treatments such as medications like buprenorphine. And while we've seen a real expansion of providers in the state of Maine who have gone through the process, this X waiver, to be able to provide that treatment, still many people just don't know who they are, where they are, who's taking patients, what kind of patients are they taking, are they taking Medicaid patients. So several other states have developed tools like this. So it'll be some combination of a link through 211, ideally available on the website, through a phone call, for people to get that information in a timely way. And we're hoping to do that within a year or so.
All right. Thank you so much for calling in, Lisa. That's Dr. Lisa Letourneau, physician and public health expert with Maine's Department of Health and Human Services. I'm going to go to a Facebook question. This is from Melissa. Maine needs less prescriptions written for these drugs. I had a minor injury. My doctor wrote a prescription for 60 OxyContin. Maybe the doctors who overprescribe should be helping pay for treatment.
That certainly contributed to the problem that we're in, but it was much more of a problem 10 years ago. Since the law was enacted in 2016, we've had almost a 50% reduction in the amount of opioids prescribed for pain. So much of a reduction that we do every week hear from patients who complain to us that they can't get adequate pain relief. We in Maine, we don't have a good track record here. In 2012, Maine prescribers were the highest prescribers of extended-release opioids. So we did have a ways to come, but we've had a very deep reduction in opioid prescribing. It was a problem, and we're not out of the woods yet. I get now access to the PMP data and see where the outliers are. The PMP is our prescription monitoring program. But it's much less of an issue than it was 10 years ago.
All right. We're going to go to Judy, who's calling from Buckfield. Hi, Judy. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me. I heard Gordon Smith speak in Bridgeton last year, and I'm hearing him again. I still haven't heard what I'm hoping to hear, which is what part of the strategic action plan addresses education. And I don't mean starting at 8. I mean starting at an earlier age, as small children. Small children early on learn not to touch a hot stove, or they'll get burned. And I think that if our children were better educated about their bodies, their biologies, the fact that the brain controls everything we do, and that we have to take care of it and using things that we know can hurt them, should be avoided. I think we should stigmatize that use early on. There's no point in doing it after somebody has fallen addicted.
Judy, thanks for your question. And Gordon, I think you're probably happy with that question, aren't you?
I did mention a little earlier, Judy, that the Department of Education and the Maine Prevention Services and our strategic plan, all the highest priority is primary prevention, that almost all, I get two or three opportunities a week to talk with people in recovery, and I always ask them, when did you start going down this road, and is there anything that could have been done to help you? And they almost always people were using substances by middle school age. So I couldn't agree more, Judy, that from the prenatal period to age 26, when our brains are formally developed, there is no period of time that we shouldn't be concerned about our kids. But the Department of Education just got some money from SAMHSA to develop a curriculum that will be available to every single school right now, when I go out to the rural areas, there are some great curriculums out there, Sources of Strength, Prime for Life, but the schools have to buy the curriculum, they have to train the teachers, they have to find time in the day to do this. And so the Department of Education has hired its first social emotional learning coordinator. We really are putting a lot of resources into prevention, and because it is the most important thing. We have to deal with what's in front of us, which is a lot of people in difficulty, and try to keep them alive and try to give them resources and keep them in recovery and do good harm reduction. But prevention really is, Judy, I think, the most important thing, and we're putting a lot of resources into it.
Can I just add quickly, too?
Excuse me. I just wanted to say one thing. I mean, while I agree that education is very important, it's also important to recognize post-traumatic stress disorder and how that plays an important role in substance use and the movement towards substance use. So I think in addition to education, we also need to recognize the trauma that occurs in our children's lives and really have sufficient mental health support in our schools and across the state to help address the post-traumatic stress and the trauma and what happens when folks are exposed to trauma.
Okay, I need to go to a break. We have lots of calls on hold. Thank you, Judy, for your question, and we'll be right back. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Senior Guide, an online resource of services and information for older Mainers and their families. More at MaineSeniorGuide.com. New England Cancer Specialists, proud to be a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative, and committed to helping patients achieve their best outcome. And Maine College of Art, offering a one-week intro to podcasting course this March with SALT alum Ashley Cleek, mecca.edu/MPR.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On February 13, 1852, a major fire destroyed the American House Hotel in Portland. The entire block from Elm Street to Preble Street was decimated. George Frederick Morris, a young draftsman at the Portland Company, painted the burning of the American House depicting this event. Morris went on to produce paintings of the Portland Fire of 1866. Morris was the founder of the Portland painting group, the Brushians, and of the Portland Society of Art.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of DN Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, Dr. Michael Eric Dyson sets his sights on someone he considers one of the greatest American poets of all time, Jay-Z. Join us for an in-depth conversation with Dyson about the life, music, poetry, and impact of Jay-Z on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what Maine is doing to address the opioid crisis. My guests are Donna Lawler with the Greater Portland Health, Gordon Smith, who is the State Director of Opioid Response, and Elaine O'Connor, nurse practitioner with Maine General. We turn now to Brittany Fearon, who's calling in. She is currently in recovery for opioid use and lives in Portland. Brittany, if you could give us a sort of brief version of your story, how did you start using opioids?
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me. I think that my story kind of starts out in a way that I have heard by being in recovery. It's kind of similar to some others. And I actually became addicted to opioids in my senior year of high school. I hate to say this to make anyone feel guilty, but my parents didn't know what they didn't know. And I was introduced to opioids through a family member's prescription. So that really progressed over the years. That led to, further opiate use and eventually to IV heroin use.
At what point did you decide you wanted to recover, and how did you find the help you needed?
I mean, it's been a process for sure. I really started to try to get help back in 2013. I was arrested for trafficking drugs, and that still wasn't stopping me from using. And I realized that, like, wow, you know, this is really out of my control. I can't stop using. I'm in all this trouble, and it's not deterring me at all. So I started to seek help at that point, and I loved what Dr. Letourneau was saying, because I had there was a really big challenge. You know, I grew up in Southern Maine, so I would say that we have the heart of the resources here, and there was just not information on a continuum of care. So I would go to detox, I would leave, I would have recurrences of use. There was just no one place for me to go and figure out, like, a long-term plan. And because of that, I continued to have slips. And I finally, you know, really got to the point in 2017 where I was just kind of like, okay, enough is enough. And I'm at the point where I'm going to do whatever it takes. I feel like, you know, this time in recovery is truly like my last. This is like, if I don't give it everything I have, that this is it for me. So I reached out, and that led to some dead ends, that led to some mistakes, and eventually it led me to the place where I am today, you know.
How long have you been not using?
I have been totally sober from all mind-altering substances since May 20th of 2017.
Congratulations. Before we let you go, Brittany, what advice do you give others who may be dealing with similar challenges?
You're not alone. And I think that I spent years thinking that I was the only person in my hometown with a heroin addiction. And that just wasn't the case. And when I started reaching out, I started realizing that, you know, other people had been through what I had been through and that they could help me.
Well, Brittany, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. That's Brittany Fearon, and she is in long-term recovery for opioid use. We're going to go now to Jennifer Van Dusen, who is calling from UNE. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for having me. It's very good to hear you. I'm also honored to be on this call with Gordon and Elaine and Lisa and the others who are doing such extraordinary work to deal with the complexity of this public health emergency that we're in the middle of. I wanted to make sure that we talk a little bit about what's going on here at the University of New England in terms of supporting our the healthcare providers of the future. And thought people might be interested to know that we're going at this from all sides, and it's been wonderful to partner with you, Gordon, and others on this effort. We received a grant from SAMHSA this year to improve the training of both of our physician assistant program and our rising osteopathic physicians, the docs of tomorrow and the physician assistants of tomorrow. Our physician assistant program has been graduating 50 physician assistants a year for the last year or two, who are already certified to be able to provide the evidence-based medication-assisted treatment to folks.
Great. Great. Jennifer, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing this. I'm going to move along, though. We're getting toward the end of the hour and a lot of people calling in. Thank you for your call. We're going to go to John in Harpswell. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for having me. I was hoping that, Gordon, if you have heard of any sort of initiatives to provide access to Maine's more rural regions with any sort of combination of telehealth and mobile access units or RVs or basically doctor's offices on wheels. That's something that you guys are in the process of doing?
Yes, there's a couple initiatives. For one thing, we are expanding the needle exchanges, and those will be mostly mobile exchanges that people will go up to a community for a couple nights a week, and the hours will be known, and people will exchange needles. Telemedicine, also on MAT, is
medication-assisted treatment,
Suboxone generally, but also methadone is another form of MAT. So telehealth in a state as geographically large as Maine, we are already having some telehealth options being used for treatment. While there's no mobile van going around providing treatment right now, there are, in fact, people that are interested in doing that. So Commissioner Lambrew with Dr. Letourneau also have a big initiative on improving access to care generally in rural Maine, and have had 4 or 5 forums in rural communities. So almost all my work is focused in places like Millinocket and Lincoln and Fort Kent and Bethel and Lubeck, Machias, Calais. I mean, this is the problem is different in the rural areas than it is in the urban areas. And we acutely understand that, and they need more of our resources.
Sure. And Elaine, I want to give you a chance to respond to John as well.
I mean, I think there's a lot of interest. I think we really need to be progressive in thinking about how we deliver this care. I mean, I think we need to be thinking about how do we do community outreach. I mean, I certainly know that I have a lot of interest in the idea of a mobile van, which provided treatment. I'm sure there's some regulatory issues there, but I think there's just a tremendous sense of positivity and hope within the treatment provider community. We're so grateful for the efforts of Gordon and the governor to really listen to us and to help us, you know, facilitate better care for our patients. So it's just it's a great time to be thinking about these creative initiatives, and certainly many of us are eager to be part of them.
John, thank you so much for your call. A comment from Robert on Facebook. Thank you for the reference to PTSD. I provide medical and clinical services to addicts, and the trauma factor is consistently prevalent. However, it is barely ever adequately attended to. And moving on to Mary. Mary, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. A couple of things. I am a little dismayed over the years with the effort made to turn something called addiction or alcoholism into substance abuse and then substance use disorder. I mean, I feel like it's a desperate situation. People are dying, and I think people who have this affliction aren't calling it that. I mean, why do we just keep changing names? And I would also say that the emphasis on removing stigma, I'm not sure, is meaningful either. Stigma, humiliation, degradation, and all that is what brings many people to their knees and to recovery. And I know hundreds and hundreds of people who wouldn't want this to be soft-spoken. And
sure, Mary. I'm going to let Donna respond.
I would say that that's the exact opposite of what we experience on a day-to-day. The stigma alone makes it difficult for people to maintain recovery and find dignity within themselves to have the strength to be able to move forward in recovery. And by making this a moral issue, we sort of miss the fact that there's a lot of other factors that affect substance use disorder. And our first and most important thing is to help folks regain their own sense of self-worth, and by continuing stigmatizing it, it keeps people away from participating in recovery, and it just perpetuates that lack of self-worth, which is a big piece in trauma and a big part of substance use disorder from the get-go.
Mary, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go to Maura in Falmouth. Hi, Maura. If you could be quick, that would be great.
Yes. So I'm concerned about the change in the Maine DOE funding to rural schools because of the federal poverty standard deviation. It used to be that students who received free or reduced lunch would enable that school to get funding for things like health and PE teachers, school counselors, and that's being changed. And I feel like this is really specific to this issue. As a health teacher, I address the teen brain and the easily addictive substances and things that students can do instead of being addicted. And I feel like we really need to look at prevention and how we can turn this around that rural schools get the funding they need. Thank you.
Sure. Gordon?
No, I agree. And Commissioner Pender-Macon and Mary Herman is working with Pender in this area. I work with Mary every day, and I can't agree more that we can't put it all onto the school because they're overwhelmed now with what they face. But we can certainly help them in every way that we can, and then rely upon the organizations that work with youth outside of the school, like the boys' clubs, the girls' clubs, the YMCAs. But again, there's now a boys' club in Corinth, so we have to come up with our own approaches in the rural areas, and we're working very hard at that.
Maura, thanks for your call. We're going to Courtney in Augusta. Hi, Courtney. Again, if you could be quick, that would be great.
Hi, yes. Hi. I'm calling because we talk a lot about the overdose crisis, but at the same time, Maine is facing a hepatitis C crisis. And I was wondering if there is any coordinated government response to that going on.
Well, Courtney, I probably know Courtney. We are doing a lot. And the Dr. Scharr at the CDC, who's been in this chair a couple times recently, while they're overwhelmed with the coronavirus issues right now, they are absolutely doing what they can. The vulnerability assessment that was done last year shows the areas of the state that are most vulnerable to hepatitis C, including Northern Penobscot County, Washington County, Somerset County, and we are putting a lot into that effort. I have some wonderful partners that work with me, the CDC and at SAMHS and at Department of Education, Department of Professional Public Safety. It's most people don't think of the collateral damage that's done to a person's body who uses IV drugs. And at any one day at the Maine Medical Center, there's a dozen people there being treated for endocarditis and deep abscesses and HIV and Hep C. And it's very, very expensive, but it's even more, you know, we don't talk as much about the money because the personal harm and damage is so horrific that it almost sounds like we're cheapening the conversation to put it about dollars. But there's no part of Maine's economy that has been dramatically affected by this issue. And it really takes all of us and communities and employers and everyone needs to come together to help us.
All right, Courtney, thank you for your call. It's going to be our last one. I apologize to anyone whose question we were not able to get to. And I know, Gordon, you had so much more to talk about with the Strategic Action Plan. Can you access that on your website? And we will provide links on our website as well as our Facebook page. And also wanted to stress, and I know, Gordon, you wanted to stress that if you are in need to call 211 and the folks there will do their best to get you connected to the help you need. Gordon Smith, Maine's Director of Opioid Response, Elaine O'Connor, a nurse practitioner with Maine General, and Donna Lawler, Clinical Director for Healthcare for the Homeless with Greater Portland Health. Thank you all. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Sandra Harris answered your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio.